WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's been more than 40 years since Che Guevara led the decisive battle of the Cuban Revolution, the Battle of Santa Clara, which toppled Cuba's military dictator, Fulgencio Batista. Che was killed in 1967 while trying to create a similar revolution in Bolivia. His face still appears on T-shirts and posters around the world. His image is used to inspire rebellion and even to sell beer. My guest, Patrick Sims, is a journalist who went in search of the Che Guevara legend by motorcycling through South America, retracing Che's 1952 motorcycle trip, the trip that radicalized Che. Sims writes about Latin American politics and third world travel for such magazines as Harper's, Outside, and Wired. His new book is called Chasing Che. I asked Sims to tell us about Che's motorcycle trip.
I think he fell deeply in love with the south of Patagonia, which was one of my secret agendas in doing the trip. I had been down there before, and it's just such a shocking and green landscape and really beautiful. And he didn't really set out with any kind of political agenda. He just wanted to goof off. He wanted to see the world. He was 23 years old, and he and his buddy went down there, and they just totally fell in love with it. And he said in his diaries from the 1952 trip that was the place he would like to come back to. That was the where he wanted to, you know, set up a medical practice and retire and live out his life. And I felt a very strong connection to that landscape. And when I read his diaries about it, I thought, you know, that's somebody who I think I could understand.
But by the time his 1952 motorcycle trip was over, he, I think, had changed his mind about setting up a practice and retiring in Patagonia.
Yeah, it radicalized him as he moved, you know, down through Argentina and up Chile and into Peru and began to see more of the poverty and the shanty towns and he was traveling very, very rough, living in leper colonies, sleeping in... as a medical student, he'd sleep in spare hospital beds in yellow fever wards to save money. And he really had a sort of deep immersion in the full misery of 1950s Latin America. And it gradually began to radicalize him. And by the end of the trip, he was thinking of himself more as a more political person, as somebody who needed to take action about what he saw.
Now, why did you want to retrace this 1952 motorcycle trip?
I guess I'd been struck by sort of the power of Che's image all over Latin America. I had spent a lot of time reporting in Cuba, and people there sort of hold him up as an example of what could have been, what might have been if he hadn't died. And, you know, there was a fellow once in Cuba who gave me a little picture of Che and said, if he were still alive, none of this would be happening. And there was that kind of attitude that, like, he was the lost, better part of us. Our dreams were lost when he died. And I wanted to try to understand where that came from and why people believed in him so deeply. And I guess I saw in his motorcycle diaries, his account of his trip, his own explanation for that, his own sort of origin point and where he felt he came from. And it was that notion of discovering a sense of solidarity with people all over the hemisphere, people who, you know, he'd grown up as an aristocrat in Argentina, and he wasn't necessarily the kind of man who would go out and identify with lepers or fight for the poor. And that was a real change in his life. And I think that travel opened those doors to him. It radicalized him. It made him aware of conditions he hadn't seen before. And it also, in a very personal sense, taught him to sort of live in motion. He talks in his diary about discovering that his destiny was to be a traveler forever. And his mother wrote to him later and said, you know, you'll always be a foreigner. And I think the travel sort of taught him to live never at home and to always be in motion and to be ultimately a revolutionary in a personal sense as well as a political one.
What do you think are the main things that Che Guevara did that gave him that iconic image of the ultimate heroic guerrilla?
Well, there's no denying he was very brave in battle. I mean, he led from the front lines. He was Fidel Castro's right-hand man, and they made their revolution in Cuba in 1957 and 58, a real battlefield revolution fought in the mountains in eastern Cuba. And Che was deeply respected by the men who served under him and loved. because he had a kind of insane courage. He really believed in what they were doing, and he fought from the front lines. He was wounded, I think, 6 or 7 times, and he had a very charismatic nature and an ability to sort of not just be a battlefield tactician, but to explain the kind of moral terrain that the guerrillas were on and why they were fighting, and to help convince people to join the revolution. He was very eloquent, and a sort of, you know, after the fighting, he became a minister in the Cuban government, but he kept doing things like manual labor, volunteering, you know, to unload bags of wheat at the port in Havana. And so people kind of really identified with him as a very immediate living person rather than just some abstract figurehead. And of course, since he died, when he died in 67, that began to reverse, and he's become, as the decades pass, more and more of a sort of two-dimensional symbol, an icon stripped of that reality.
Did you meet a lot of people along the way on your trip who had either met Che or at least claimed to have?
Yeah, there were a lot in both categories. There were quite a few people I managed to turn up. I was very surprised who had met him. You know, when I was down in Patagonia, I just used his diary and went around and, you know, looked up the family names and so on. And I found a fellow named Oscar von Puttkamer who had been a small child when Che stayed in their house. I looked up Che's ex-girlfriend from 1952. I found a guerrilla in Cusco who had trained under him in Cuba. I even, at the end, went and looked up Che's traveling partner, who was a fellow who went on the entire trip with him and still lives in Cuba and is sort of in charge of curating the Cuban government's version of Che's life.
Yeah, in fact, you say the reason why this guy, Alberto Granado, went on the trip with Che is that it was Granado's motorcycle.
Yeah. They were sort of partners in crime in a way. They were friends. But above all, Alberto Granado owned the beat-up old Norton motorcycle that they were going to attempt to cross the continent on. And they got pretty far along. Eventually, Che crashed and destroyed the motorbike, but that didn't ruin their friendship. And they kept on by hitchhiking and being stowaways and, you know, riding on trucks and so on, in a very kind of slow, difficult travel over the Andes through Peru. And Alberto Granado is a pretty diehard defender of the Cuban regime to this day, but it was really interesting to talk to him and sort of sit there as two motorcyclists chatting about the towns we'd been in and how things had changed and what was and wasn't the same 44 years later.
How does his version of the 1952 motorcycle trip with Che Guevara compare to Che's diaries of that trip?
Well, I guess there's two differences. One is a fundamental sort of character difference between the two. Che, as he put it in his diary, set out for adventure. He called himself a dreamer. He wanted to go to the South Pacific and pursue South Seas maidens, and just, you know, he had no political agenda, really. He was a lark. Alberto Granado, who was a few years older than him, was already at that point a dedicated Marxist and tended to see things in very political senses. So they had different purposes and agendas in the trip. And in a second sense, I think Alberto Granado sort of edited his account in order to make Che look a little better than he was, and not necessarily in any important ways. There were just a series of small discrepancies between the two diaries. There was an incident at one point they volunteered as firemen in a little town in Chile because they were stuck in this town and there was a fire. And according to Che's diary, Alberto Granado rushed into this burning building and saved a cat. And according to Alberto Granado's diary, Che rushed into the building and saved the cat. And it can't be both ways. I don't know who's fibbing, but I got the feeling that not only were their political, their sort of personal agendas very different, but that the diaries, you know, reflect a certain amount of positioning of the sort of Che product in our contemporary culture.
Has Granado kind of made a career of having taken this motorcycle trip with Che?
Yeah, he gets a lot of status out of it. He's a sort of friend of Che, as they called him in Cuba, somebody who knew him. That's a very high status position there. And he, you know, you'll see him at events in Cuba, you know, that when they're opening up a new golf course or something, they'll have a picture of him in the paper. And it says, you know, Alberto Granado, a friend of Che, tests the golf links. And I don't think that's something that ordinary Cubans necessarily get to do. It helps to have been a friend of Che.
Now, you mentioned you talked to a guerrilla who trained under Che Guevara. What did the guerrilla, the former guerrilla, tell you about Che?
I guess I was most struck by his sort of sense of great regret. He felt that he'd failed Che in a very personal way. He told me, you know, to me, Che was a saint, and he sent us, he trained us, and we failed. And I think I actually talked to a lot of ex-guerrillas on this trip, and just universally, they felt a sort of great disappointment that their dreams had been false, that the revolution wasn't coming, it never had been coming, that they were mistaken. But even so, there was a great sense of loyalty in his voice to the man he had known who had inspired them so much. And Che was a really charismatic leader who sort of exerted a kind of personal influence over a whole generation of these intellectuals across Latin America, everywhere in Latin America. Dozens and dozens of guerrilla groups sprang up imitating him. Their leaders trained under him. There's some guerrillas still in the field today in Colombia who trained under him in 1963. And even one of their leaders even puts on the little beret and sort of strikes the Che pose and looks up for the photographers in exactly the same way as Che would pose, you know, trying to evoke that connection, that image of the past, and hold on to that, you know, what the Cubans call the heroic years, the spirit of great revolutionary change that was supposedly going to sweep over Latin America.
You say there are anti-communist groups that see Che as their hero, too.
Yeah, there's a even the Contras in Nicaragua would look up to him as a sort of a pan-theological guerrilla. It doesn't really matter what your ideology was. He was a charismatic guerrilla leader who shot his way into power, and that's the basic example. You find people in Argentina who were associated with the right-wing death squads and even leaders of them who claimed to revere and admire Che. So the ideological differences no longer hold much meaning. There's this kind of universal agreement in Latin America and in many European countries as well that he was an inspiring figure who did, made the ultimate sacrifice to speak for the poor and the disenfranchised. And I guess you find that the poor and the disenfranchised don't have a lot of spokesmen, so they're willing to take anybody.
Now, you met a lot of people who met Che or claimed to have met Che. Is there a story that you came to think of as the kind of typical apocryphal story about meeting Che?
Well, there are so many that were so startling and strange sometimes. I made a habit as I traveled along. I was on the road a long time, 4.5 months, about 10,000 miles. And I would feign ignorance. I'd say to people, so who's this Che Guevara character in the papers? You know, what's the story with him? And I'd get these just incredible tales that he was, you know, really a European or a North American, that he was, you know, Castro's brother, that he was a drug dealer, that he was, you know, any kind of crazy thing. You know, there were all these stories about he wasn't really killed. He's alive today in such and such place. Just the most fantastical accounts. Somebody told me he was an internationally famous car thief. You know, just things that made no sense at all. But again and again, people felt that some sort of connection to him. And I think it's because there are so few heroes in Latin America. There's so few people who even tried to speak up and do anything about the tremendous poverty. And you don't have to agree with his ideology to sort of notice the tremendous emotional power that his image has for people who are the down and out of the world.
My guest is journalist Patrick Sims, and he retraced Che Guevara's 1952 trip across Latin America and has written a new book called Chasing Che, A Motorcycle Journey in Search of the Guevara Legend. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Patrick Sims, and after retracing Che Guevara's 1952 motorcycle journey across Latin America, he's written a new book called Chasing Che, A Motorcycle Journey in Search of the Guevara Legend. Let's get to Che Guevara as a pop icon. I mean, there were souvenirs, I imagine, throughout Latin America with his likeness on it. Why don't you describe the range of souvenirs that you found?
I was nearly run off the road quite a few times by trucks that had Che Guevara mud flaps on them. I don't know the symbolism of that, but it, you know, I'd be sort of hurtling off the side of the road as a truck passed with Che mud flaps. Cuba is the main place for buying Che souvenirs, but you can get them all over. You know, they make skis with Che Guevara's likeness on them, beer, cigarette lighters, nail clippers, T-shirts, of course, rock albums. You know, Rage Against the Machine puts Che on their albums and flies Che flags at their concerts. I bought a pair of Che maracas, which I really like to break out sometimes and play on.
Did you talk to souvenir vendors about what sold best and how the trends seem to change from year to year?
Yeah, I mean, far and away the bestseller, you'll see them, they're everywhere in Cuba now. Che tourism is one of the main props under the Cuban economy, and I think far and away their big seller is what they look for is Europeans who want to buy Che T-shirts, and you can see at any one place. I was just in Cuba a few months ago. You see 25 or 30 different varieties of Che T-shirts, and this sort of intense competition among the vendors, you know, and then the international marketplace is no slouch, at exploiting his image either. Swatch produces a special line of Che swatches, which are only available. The Cuban government bought the entire production run and sells them for profit at Jose Marti Airport outside Havana. So everybody gets in on the act. It's a big cash generator.
The ultimate capitalist transformation of the communist revolutionary.
His ex-girlfriend said to me, "It's just too ironic. He's become a consumer item."
Now, Che Guevara transformed himself. Tell us something about his family background.
He was the motorcycle journey really changed his life and his world. He was born into a kind of aristocratic family in Argentina. They didn't have a lot of money, but they're very intellectual and educated. And he went to medical school and never practiced as a doctor, but he had a kind of a noblesse oblige. I think his mother was a very amazing character, a beautiful, wealthy woman, a political radical who raised him to be very independent and filled their house with, Spanish Civil War veterans and artists and writers. But they didn't have any money, so he also grew up, he was in street gangs when he was a kid and had a sort of rough and tumble childhood. And knew that side of the world as well. And he also, from a very early age, suffered from terrible asthma, so that his whole life was kind of a physical challenge. And I think that's crucial to understanding him. He had what's sometimes called the asthmatic personality, which is reacting against the feeling of suffocation, against the feeling of weakness by polishing your will, your willpower, and always fighting on. And he was just incredibly rugged. I came away from that motorcycle trip with a sort of deep respect for his physical toughness. He had to keep going. He had to keep pushing, even when it was desperate. And he probably believed that they couldn't succeed. He still fought on. And he ended up dying in a very squalid way at the end of a failed mission in Bolivia, but unwilling to ever quit.
Patrick, when you were, spending 16-hour days on your motorcycle in rainstorms and feeling quite despondent, what got you through it? I mean, unlike Che Guevara, you don't, to my knowledge, have asthma. You're not the asthmatic personality. You weren't a revolutionary in the making. Did you ever say to yourself, why am I doing this?
Yeah, all the time. But, I mean, one of the great lessons of the trip is it's amazing what you're capable of when you have no choice. I would have things like I had a terrible accident in deep, deep southern Chile. I have no idea what happened. I just woke up on the side of the road with a motorcycle on top of me and a broken rib. You know, I was in the middle of nowhere. There wasn't a single other car around. And what do you do in that situation? You get up and you go on. You have to. It's not like there was any choice. Again and again, I'd find myself in places and experiences where I was very vulnerable. There was nothing to do but trust people by the side of the road. And again, I found that those people always came through for me. I was sort of shocked at how good human beings turn out to be, because people could have taken advantage of me over and over again in any kind of situation when I had breakdowns, when I was, sleeping in strange villages in the middle of nowhere. Between not having any choice at the worst moments and between that sense of wanting to live up to the sort of good treatment I was receiving, I found it kind of necessary to keep going and keep pushing on and keep trying to, in the end, reach Bolivia and see the final things he saw, the places where he died, the places where he fought and died.
Well, on the lighter side, one of the things you learned from Che Guevara was how to freeload. After reading his diary, you decided that when it came to freeloading, Che Guevara was a prince.
Yeah, I'm a little ashamed of it, but I'd traveled a lot before I started on this trip. I'd even hitchhiked across South America once, and I'd sort of incorporated the notion that when you're on the road like that, you're living out of a backpack, you're far from home, nobody knows who you are. There's a kind of a glancing quality to the life, and it's very tempting sometimes to, you know, as Che would do, fabricate these stories about who they were and just kind of throw themselves on the mercy of people. It's very easy to sort of become rude and just insist that people take care of you when you don't have any resources and you're far from home. And he was a champion at catching free meals and drink off people, getting into parties. He was always in search of liquor. And I used to study up on his techniques and use them. You know, like I got into a firehouse one time and Che had this whole technique of refusing to have a drink unless someone would give him food. So if someone offered him a drink, he wouldn't drink it. He'd just leave it sitting there until they got insulted and said, "Why aren't you drinking?" And he said, "Well, you know, in my country, we're used to having some food with it." So then the person would buy him some food. And I didn't really believe that would work until I tried it, and it worked perfectly. So there's a lot of things you can learn from Che.
Patrick Sims is the author of Chasing Che. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Patrick Sims, author of the new book Chasing Che, A Motorcycle Journey in Search of the Guevara Legend. It's about the motorcycle trip Sims took across South America, retracing Che's 1952 motorcycle trip. You went to the place where Che Guevara's remains were secretly buried, and then they were in 1997 dug up and taken to Santa Clara in Cuba, where he led the decisive victory against the Batista regime. Tell us a little bit about your visit to the place where his remains were secretly buried.
That was the end of my trip, and I got in there. I just finished about 10,000 miles. I was about 4 months into the trip, and I was just utterly exhausted. And it's this sort of brown, parched landscape in southern Bolivia, very desperate, these tiny little hamlets. And I got into town, and immediately on my arrival, because I was the only gringo there, a fellow from the local radio station interviewed me about who I was and what I was doing here. And unbeknownst to me, that interview was broadcast over the entire province. So the next day when I set out, you know, in this very remote area to go try and see Che Guevara's, you know, where he fought his final battle, where he was killed, where he was buried, as I drove down the road, villagers come running out of their huts saying, "Hey, you're the gringo on the radio." And, you know, I talked to Che Guevara right on this spot 30 years ago, right here. And he told me this and that. And you never quite know whether to believe those stories because there were so many of them. And I think people get very excited about having a connection to him. But I'd sort of, wherever I'd go, I'd be confronted by people who'd heard me on the radio and wanted to argue about Che Guevara's doctrines and ply me with moonshine. And it was a very funny and odd end to the trip. You know, you bump into these European Che tourists who had Che tattoos sort of wandering through this landscape, and it was just a surreal place and very grim and sad, but in the end, the villagers sort of, it's the most exceptional thing that ever happened to them there, and they sort of look back on it all kind of fondly.
Were Che's remains still buried there when you were in Valle Grande?
Yeah. During the course of the 4.5 months that I chronicle in Chasing Che, they were searching for his remains. And so it's a constant theme in my book about the sort of the search for this phantom remains. In the end, they actually did find them. He was buried in this vast valley. You know, they sort of found most of his remains. And there was a very sort of ugly necrophiliac argument between Argentina, Bolivia, and Cuba over who got the remains. And eventually Cuba won, and they were exported to Cuba and put on display, and there was a very grand funeral there, which I attended, and he's now a sort of official museum exhibit in the Cuban Revolution.
Well, as you point out, in Cuba, Che Guevara is part of the establishment.
Yeah, it's funny. When you get to Cuba, and a lot of places elsewhere in Latin America, he's a leftist symbol, but in Cuba, a lot of people who are dissatisfied with the regime also exploit his image, and then he's At the same time, you know, if you walk into a Cuban school, you will see his name on the blackboard. His picture is in every school I've ever been in Cuba. His face is everywhere. He is the official patron saint of the revolution. His lessons are taught to children all through school. Toddlers literally nap under his gaze, and every child in Cuba takes the pledge, we will be like Che. So he's got this sort of twin nature as a kind of the establishment, a symbol, you know, an official propaganda symbol whose face is seven stories tall on the side of buildings. But at the same time, he's used in a kind of subversive way by the dissidents within Cuba who think he represented some more humane trend in the revolution, a more hopeful and noble and personally sacrificial kind of leadership than they have now. I think people are exhausted in Cuba, and he symbolizes those hopeful early years, what they call the heroic years.
After you completed your motorcycle trip, retracing Che Guevara's trip, you came to the conclusion that Che Guevara was a brutal man.
I think that's been sort of washed away with the forgetting of the years. His life's work, he was a very inspirational man, a charismatic leader. He gave a lot of beautiful speeches. But in a lot of ways, his life's work was setting up ambushes and was teaching others how to conduct, you know, recon. He was a soldier. He viewed himself as a sort of intellectual soldier of fortune fighting in the socialist cause. He directly trained and led or inspired or directed guerrilla movements across Latin America and in Africa. He was personally a violent man. He, you know, when they were in the mountains of eastern Cuba and he was with Fidel Castro, they caught their first traitor, a guerrilla who defected, and Castro said he has to be killed, he has to be sentenced to death. But no one would volunteer to do it except Che. And I think that he believed in a very kind of harsh world. He believed in violence. He said, violence is the midwife of the new societies. We mustn't be afraid of a little violence. And that, too, is his legacy. Everywhere I went in Latin America, I saw the scars of this tremendous epic of decades of violence and guerrilla warfare. And it's not all his fault, but he did his very best to increase the violence, to polarize the climates, to try to train people to use violence to be a midwife of the new societies. And the cost for that was incredible. It's a continent covered with mass graves, with fresh scars. And that, too, has to be part of his legacy.
Of course, his violence was fighting against violent regimes. There was already a lot of violence in Latin America.
Yeah, he didn't step into an empty world. I mean, he was reacting against a very legitimate kind of constant repression. I mean, for example, in Cuba, the conditions there before the revolution were awful, and people rallied to their cause and responded to the guerrillas and joined them and were willing to sort of liberate themselves under arms. But he tried to export that model to make it apply in places like the Congo and Africa, where he backed a guerrilla army that fell apart, or Bolivia, where he believed he was coming to liberate these peasants who, you know, were living under oppression, and indeed they were brutally poor and still are. But the peasants didn't welcome him. They turned on him. They ratted him out to the army because they didn't know who he was. They viewed him as a meddlesome outsider. And it was easy, I think, to extrapolate too far from the example of the kind of liberating Cuban revolution, which really was a legitimate middle-class popular rebellion that needed to happen, and then to try to export that to societies where there was a lot of repression and there was a lot of violence, but that ultimately adding violence, you know, adding, as many of the guerrillas told me, their own efforts simply made things worse. Jacobo Timmerman said all the guerrillas achieved was to grease the wheels of the killing machine.
Che Guevara was considered very, very handsome, very rugged looking, and that certainly has helped his iconic status. Do you think he would have kind of reached that iconic status if he looked more nerdy? or just you know, like less macho and less attractive?
I think it's true that some of the power of some of his power today comes from the fact that he was a very dashing fellow, and that was always the case. Even when he sort of rose to be a battlefield commander in Cuba, It was partly his eloquence. It was partly the sort of dashing figure that he cut. And a lot of his sort of worldwide image today rests on a single photograph that was taken of him one day in 1960 in a beret, sort of his eyes burning off into the future. And, you know, it was an image that sort of caught a sort of fiery look in his eyes. And you can't underestimate the power of that image as a symbol, even when, you know, the reality of Che Guevara, whether, you know, whether he actually looked that way or not, you know, isn't necessarily what determines whether people care about him. He is a symbol. He is two-dimensional now. And the angle of the beret, the length of the beard, and the fire in his eyes all contribute a lot to that.
Well, Patrick Sims, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Patrick Sims is the author of Chasing Che. He's a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. Coming up, jazz mandolinist Don Steenburgh. This is Fresh Air.